From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, and this morning, Katie Mullally and I speak with science writer Daniel Oberhaus about, get this, extraterrestrial languages. It's the history of trying to talk to our alien neighbors and if interstellar communication is even possible. Then we talk about the myths and truths of the creative brain and what truly constitutes creativity with Anna Abraham, director of the Torrance Center for Creativity and Talent Development at the University of Georgia. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
Well, long before Voyager 1 set out across the solar system carrying the golden record, humans have been attempting to communicate with extraterrestrials by sending messages into space. Even today, we are still engaged in, well, we're attempting, this interstellar communication. But are extraterrestrial beings receiving these messages? If so, could they even understand? Our guest, Daniel Oberhaus, in his new book, Extraterrestrial Languages, leads readers on a quest for extraterrestrial communication and considers how philosophy, linguistics, mathematics, science, and art have informed the design or maybe limited the effectiveness of our interstellar messaging. Daniel Oberhaus is a science writer based in Brooklyn, New York. He is the founder of the deep tech communications agency House and was previously a staff writer at Wired. Daniel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the intro, we talk about the Voyager 1 going out with its golden record, but was that the first attempt we humans have made at sending messages into space?
So the Voyager was a landmark in terms of our, you know, interstellar communications efforts, but it wasn't the first scientific message we sent out into the cosmos. And the history of extraterrestrial communication actually predates it by several centuries, which I think people are often surprised to learn. There's this somewhat innate human impulse to want to talk to non-human intelligences. And before we understood that the cosmos was filled with stars and a lot of those stars had planets, this exercise was phrased in ecclesiastical terms. So people working in the clergy were trying to figure out how to talk to angels. And as early as the 16th century, actually, there were members of the church who began to imagine what it might be like to contact an intelligent race that they, you know, thought might live on the moon. So that's kind of how things plodded along for the, you know, first few centuries of what I would describe as extraterrestrial communication. But then in the 19th century, as we started to learn more about our own solar system, these efforts became increasingly rationalized. And so initially, before we had a good way to look at the moon or Mars, there was serious intellectuals thinking that there might, these celestial bodies might be inhabited in our own solar system. We quickly learned that the moon did not seem to harbor any sort of intelligent life. But, you know, as late as the early 20th century, there was quite a bit of speculation that Mars might actually be home to intelligent species. And so our initial efforts were largely focused on trying to figure out how to communicate with aliens that were presumed to live on Mars. The ideas that people had were very much signs of their times. To give a somewhat outrageous example, in the 19th century, there were proposals to coat the Eiffel Tower in mirrors and use that to signal in Morse code to the Martians. There were proposals to build a giant mirror on the surface of the Earth and actually burn messages into the surface of Mars. And a mathematician from Austria also had the great idea of digging massive trenches in the Sahara Desert, filling them with kerosene, and lighting them on fire to send mathematical messages to the Martians. And so, you know, for better or worse, probably for the better, these ideas never came to fruition. But then as soon as we developed the technology to communicate using radio, things started to get really interesting. So that happened in the early 20th century. That was, you know, the first experiments in radio astronomy. And then after that, we began to look beyond our own solar system and figure out how we might send messages to intelligences that might live around other stars rather than just in our own cosmic backyard.
So on Earth, as humans, we have our language, quote unquote, isn't just the words we say. It's our reactions, our physical, our body language, even our emotional responses. A lot of times are considered languages. But how do we, can we convey those kind of things when we send these messages out? Or are we just assuming this one little narrow swath of quote-unquote language is just something that these aliens will hear? And Do they define language the same way we do?
It's a great question. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think what we're really talking about when we talk about interstellar communication is we're looking for what we might consider true universals, right? Something that we might share in common with an extraterrestrial intelligence that doesn't share our culture. They probably almost, you know, certainly they're not going to speak English or Mandarin or any of these languages that we're familiar with on Earth. And that creates in itself a lot of problems. But to your bigger question about various communication modes, I think people have a tendency to think about communication purely in the context of language. So the way we're speaking to one another right now, perhaps written language, these are incredibly information dense mediums. And, you know, there's a reason why we use language for communication. But of course, when I communicate with a friend, when I'm talking to them, I'm giving them so much other information that contextualizes what might be coming out of my mouth, right? The way I'm standing, there's micro expressions on my face that humans are evolved to pick up on, these very, very subtle cues that actually give us quite a bit of information about what the receiver is actually trying to say. So the difficult thing when you're operating in a interstellar context at, you know, these massive distances, we're talking about communicating with a civilization over probably, you know, the span of thousands of years. And it's not a one-to-one, it's a many-to-many type problem where it's civilizations talking as opposed to individuals. You lose a lot of that context that is very vital for having fluid conversations on Earth. So, you know, that has kind of really constrained what we're able to do in the interstellar messaging context, right? And for instance, something that I think is often lost in this is when we're trying to communicate with an extraterrestrial, right? You know, we have this faculty of vision we see in a very specific, you know, range of light, but that is very dependent on how we have evolved on Earth. And so if we were to send, say, a visual message to aliens, like all of a sudden now we're presuming that they have the same faculty of vision as us, that they're going to look at what might look very abstract to them, whereas to us, it's like, oh, that's the letter A or that's the letter B. And so all of a sudden things start to get very, very complicated. And what extraterrestrial messaging is really all about is how can we distill that into its core essence? What is the like most fundamental thing that we could send to an alien that will be recognized by any intelligent species in the universe? And as soon as you kind of start thinking about the question in that frame, it becomes just immediately obvious how rare universals really are. And for the last 60 years, that's kind of been the focus of these scientific efforts, is trying to figure out what is that thing that we might share in common with any extraterrestrial in the galaxy.
Daniel, I was wondering, as you were talking before, it made me think of something I haven't thought about in a really long time, about different ways throughout history that we have tried to communicate with whatever beings might be out there, be they, you know, angels, as you talked about in the beginning, or extraterrestrials. But I started to think about those lines in Peru, the Nazca lines. Are you familiar with those?
Yes, I've actually had the opportunity to see them. They're incredibly beautiful. Yeah, but I think, you know, that's actually a really interesting example to me, in the sense of, you know, when I think about extraterrestrial intelligence, and, you know, what is a useful comparison here? And, you know, maybe we can get into it a little bit later. But for instance, like the way we communicate with animals is a great analog, and actually has been used as a kind of prototype exercise in communicating with extraterrestrials. But I also think another interesting way to think about it is when we think about our own deep history on Earth, right? And like if we take the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, for example, and that language, that was a very robust civilization. They're not that deep in our history. We're talking about the equivalent of a few thousand years separating us from the Egyptians, but we almost lost the ability to understand anything that they were saying. And this is our own species, right? If we never had the Rosetta Stone, we may never have understood what that culture was actually writing on their walls. And there's many examples of this. You know, when we think about like Linear B, this is still an untranslated manuscript. The Nazca lines, you know, we can have theories about what they meant, but it really kind of puts it, at least in my mind, into sharp relief how difficult this problem is. Because when we're sending radio messages into outer space, at this point, it seems pretty clear that, you know, in our local cosmic environment, you know, we're talking maybe on the span of a couple hundred light years, there doesn't seem to be any intelligence that we can find. So if we do make contact with an extraterrestrial, that radio signal is probably going to be traveling for thousands of years. And so the equivalent to me is thinking about, well, okay, imagine trying to communicate with the ancient, you know, Egyptians, and how difficult that was on Earth. And we share so much with them. It's like a 99.9% overlap, and we still almost were unable to understand what they're saying. And what's interesting to me about this is these challenges also extended to the future. And so, you know, an example of this is in the 1980s and early 1990s, Carl Sagan and several people who were working involved in SETI and this, you know, concept of messaging extraterrestrials, they were recruited for a project by the Department of Energy, where the Department of Energy was trying to figure out, how do we store nuclear waste underground? And this is still, you know, an ongoing issue. But part of the problem with that is, you know, if we are going to put this very toxic waste in a deep geological repository, this is going to be dangerous for, you know, on the order of like 10,000 years. And so the Department of Energy recruited a team, including Carl Sagan, John Lomberg, who was the designer involved with the Golden Record, to put together a series of messages that would be able to communicate with our far future ancestors to communicate, hey, this is dangerous. Don't come in. Don't open this thing up. This is going to kill you. And if you read those reports, it's incredible how difficult it is and how much things that we might take for granted, like a skull and crossbones today, we might all recognize as a symbol of danger. But if you look at the past, skull and crossbones actually had a pretty wide variety of means. It's usually associated with death, but not necessarily in the way of like, hey, don't come here, right? It could be a sign of honor. It really, like when they were going through this exercise, it becomes clear just how difficult it is to think about communicating even with your own species on the timeframes that we're talking about with extraterrestrials, which we'll probably share much, much less in common with. So I think, you know, the Nazca lines, these deep geological repository signs, these are all great examples of the magnitude of the challenge we're dealing with.
Wow, that's so interesting. So just out of curiosity on that project, what emerged as how to warn our future generations about nuclear waste in a repository deep in the earth?
They had several ideas emerge. There were a lot of artists involved in this project. They didn't actually align on any particular vision for it, but you know, one that really stands out to me is there was a artist concept. It almost looks like a, you know, it's a field full of these massive giant spikes. Like it looks very just stark, scary. It's, you know, it looks like something out of a horror film. And the idea here was to kind of try to convey like, hey, this is not a great place. There's this famous quote from this report where they were trying to figure out basically how to communicate. This is not a place of honor, like do not enter, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, a lot of their ideas were quite, you know, I think quite creative. The proof, I guess, will ultimately be in the pudding, right? It's trying to prove a counterfactual. It's like, we are going to need to store this nuclear waste at some point. And to be totally honest, we still don't have a great answer for how to solve that particular issue, right? And so I would highly encourage anyone listening to go check out the report. It's fascinating. There's a lot of really cool art in it about how they were thinking about it. And it's a direct parallel to what we're talking about in the context of interstellar communication.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Daniel Oberhaus. He is the author of the book, Extraterrestrial Languages. Well, let's get back to the Golden Record, because we made some assumptions when we sent it off, actually two of them on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. There's the diagram, there's the record, there's the player, but we're making assumptions. Well, you tell us what assumptions we're making when we sent that out.
I think the Voyager Golden Record is really interesting. A really interesting milestone in the history of interstellar communication. And there's a few reasons for that. One is, to date, it is truly the only physical artifact that we've sent, you know, for the purpose of being, you know, received and hopefully understood by an extraterrestrial intelligence. The Voyager spacecraft are still to this day the only spacecraft to ever enter the interstellar medium. And what's a little bit interesting and kind of important to understand about this is the Golden Record was conceived as a interstellar message, right? But the designers of this Golden Record, which included Carl Sagan, his wife, Andrienne, and several other kind of leading thinkers in the SETI community, all very smart people, they understood the extremely low odds of this particular spacecraft being picked up. And like when you think about the just enormity of the cosmos and you have this tiny little spacecraft zipping through there, the odds of it actually getting picked up by any extraterrestrial civilization is incredibly low. And so it's an interesting exercise, but they were all kind of aware that realistically, this probably isn't ever going to get intercepted by an alien. So then why do it? And you know, what were they even doing on that Golden Record? Well, their thinking was, I think, very exemplary of kind of the challenges that we're still dealing with in the interstellar messaging context, where when you communicate with an extraterrestrial civilization, you're trying to represent humanity, not a particular culture, not a particular person. So it's not, you know, you don't just have your president write a missive and then send it out on behalf of Earth. That seems incredibly irresponsible. Earth is full of, you know, diverse cultures, diverse ways of thinking. And trying to encapsulate that all in a single message, the entire diversity of the human experience, is a massive, massive challenge. And so the way they approached that, I think, you know, was pretty forward thinking for their time. They collected music from a range of different cultures. They embedded lots of images of the Earth, you know, scientific diagrams. They even had a brainwave recording from Carl Sagan's wife, Andrienne, embedded into the record when, you know, as the story goes, she was meditating on her love, Carl, which is, you know, beautiful. But, you know, will an alien actually know that that is a record of a human brainwave that was thinking about it in this context? Probably not. But what is interesting about that is, you know, as a physical artifact, this was a phonographic record that was, you know, plated in gold. And, you know, will an alien have a record player? Like, are they going to be listening to music in the same way? Probably not. But what they could do is, you know, you could use an electron microscope, for instance, and you can actually look at the physical grooves within the phonograph, which will give you the raw data that you would be, you know, in theory, able to extract and get that information out, even if you didn't have a record player with a stylus. As it happens, the Voyager record did come with a stylus in case they want to play it. But I think the Golden Record was really about kind of trying to encapsulate this challenge, being like, this probably is never going to be intercepted by an alien, but these issues about how to communicate on behalf of our entire species are well worth thinking about. And when you channel that into a particular project, you start to understand really how difficult it is. And, you know, as an example of this, there was two other spacecraft, the Pioneer spacecraft, that also had plaques with many similar things to the Voyager record on that plaque. And it, you know, Carl Sagan was involved in that too. And the team was kind of taken to task because on the plaque and on the Golden Record, there's depictions of a man and a woman. They look very, you know, Western. And of course, you know, there's many different bodies. There's many different cultures. Like, not everyone on Earth looks like this. And so how do you capture that huge diversity? It's a massive challenge. That was kind of our, you know, one of our first attempts at doing that in a rigorous way. But now, you know, with the internet, the fact that we're mostly using radio as a means of communication when we think about interstellar messaging, that opens up the ability to do a lot more. You know, for instance, there's been proposals to send the entire internet or like all of Wikipedia into space, which allows you to kind of capture everything and just dump it on the alien. Hope they can understand what we're talking about. But yeah, the Golden Record was really kind of the first attempt to figure out how we might capture this broad variety of human experience and condense it into a manageable format.
Yes, I think that dumping all the internet on some alien planet might be a really good deterrent. I wouldn't want to come here if I saw all of that. Well, let's talk about aliens that have come here. There's a couple of movies that come to mind immediately: Close Encounters of the Third Kind and We Communicated Through Music. But then there was The Arrival a few years ago, which was such a great movie. What was your interpretation of how she was able to translate for those extraterrestrial beings?
Yeah, it's a great question. Arrival and the short story it's based on by Ted Chiang is, you know, one of my favorite films and short stories ever written. And I think that's because it's actually really grounded in linguistics. You know, Ted really kind of understood the challenges here and then rendered this as a very compelling story. Before talking about Arrival, though, I'll talk about another film that most people are familiar with, which is Contact. And so just kind of like frame what we're talking about is Contact is a little bit more realistic in the sense of like you don't actually need an alien to visit Earth. And in that film, you know, Jodie Foster is sitting there with her headphones and she gets a message from space. It's very unambiguous. And that's probably not going to happen. That's a little bit less realistic. I think, you know, if we were to receive or to send a message, we'll probably spend decades debating its contents in scientific journals. It won't just be immediately apparent what we're receiving. So that's kind of the format, like the Contact format with radio messaging is actually how it's done today. What's interesting to me about Arrival, though, is from the conceptual standpoint of what it means to actually try to decipher a language from another intelligence. In that movie, the linguist played by Amy Adams, she has it pretty easy, right? She gets to actually go see the alien and have face-to-face contact with it. But when she's, you know, making this contact, these aliens have these really beautifully rendered symbols that represent their language. And a lot of the movie is about trying to decipher what those symbols mean. And I guess I won't spoil it for listeners if they haven't seen it. I would highly encourage everyone to go watch it if they are interested. But what it ultimately comes down to is these messages don't just exist, you know, in a linear way like they do, you know, for instance, with our language. Like they have this time component that the human brain really isn't equipped to understand. That to me is just a really great rendering of the types of problems we're dealing with, right? Because the things that we take for granted in terms of how our language is structured, the ways that we communicate with each other on Earth, it seems very natural to us, but we're a sample size of one. And so to the extent that we understand where language comes from and why we have this faculty, we don't actually know how universal that really is, right? Like there is this idea that there could be other modes of communicating in a linguistic format. And I think a useful way of kind of contextualizing this is when we think about animal communication, right? So as far as we know, humans are the only species on Earth that have the faculty of language in the way that I think anyone listening to this will understand what we're talking about when we talk about language. But of course, animals communicate with each other. If you have a pet dog or cat, you know, I think most people think that at some level they're able to communicate with them. You know, animals communicate with each other. You know, ants, for instance, can leave scents, like these like pheromones that they're able to use as a communication mode. There's so many different modes of animal communication, but none of them have the attributes of language, one of them being, you know, a hierarchical grammatical structure. So, you know, when we think about famous instances of animals that seem to be able to wield speech, Coco the gorilla is probably one of the better known ones, where Coco was able to take elements of sentences and seemingly combine them into novel utterances using language. So the kind of the challenge with that, though, is what Coco was doing was, you know, linearly arranging words to form novel utterances. But that is actually not what is a defining characteristic of language. It is very important for communication. But what's amazing about human language is that we have this hierarchical structure where like a word at the front of a sentence can actually be related to the word at the end. That ability gives us the ability to form novel utterances basically infinitely, whereas, you know, no animal that we know of actually has that capacity. So they might have something that looks like language, but it's kind of more similar to what ChatGPT is doing, where it's almost probabilistic matching like this word, now this word, now this word, without really understanding how word A relates to word D in the linear sequence. So it looks linear, but actually there's a hierarchy behind this, and that's uniquely human. So we have no idea whether or not an alien would have a similar faculty, or maybe even a more advanced faculty, as such as portrayed in Arrival.
Right. So Daniel, that leads me to thinking about how much and the extent to which we have studied like dolphins and whales, and, you know, maybe not a grammar or and perhaps just single utterances, but that kind of relates to this whole topic, right? Because they're not a human species.
Yes. And, you know, dolphins are a really interesting example. They're deeply, deeply involved in the history of extraterrestrial communication. In fact, when Frank Drake in 1960, he launched the first SETI project, where he trained a radio telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, on a nearby star to listen for radio signals. Nothing came through. But after the fact, he assembled a bunch of people, Carl Sagan, several Nobel laureates, basically any like the who's who of the scientific community who was taking the idea of interstellar communication seriously. They all met at Green Bank to kind of talk about, okay, well, what's next? Now that we've kind of broken the seal on this idea of monitoring outer space for extraterrestrial communication, where do we go from here? And one of the questions that they were focused on is, well, you know, if we do actually hear from an alien, you know, that immediately creates a problem, which is, how are we going to respond? What was really interesting to me about that particular conference in 1963, if I'm remembering correctly, was one of the attendees was a man by the name of John Lilly, who is famous for his work and research on dolphins. And what's interesting about dolphins is they have, as far as we know, and this applies to other cetaceans as well, but dolphins, whales, animals such as these, they seem to have incredibly sophisticated communication mechanisms, as far as we can understand, that are approaching language. So dolphins seem to have names for one another. They can reference objects that are absent from their environment. So this is pretty astounding. And John Lilly had dedicated his entire life to trying to communicate with dolphins in a way that is just beyond, you know, how you might communicate with your pet. It got kind of complicated. He had a facility down in the Caribbean where he literally flooded a house and lived, cohabitated with dolphins. He was injecting them with LSD to try to communicate with them. Pretty problematic in some ways, but the idea that dolphins might have the key to understanding how we might communicate with extraterrestrials is something that is, you know, still with us today. It's they really are a model in terms of how we think about what it might be like to make contact with an alien. There are still researchers that, you know, go off the coast of Florida every year. They get in the water. They have these computers that they use to interpret dolphin sounds. And a lot of them are still heavily involved in SETI. And so this has always kind of been a model for us when we think about what might it be like to communicate with an intelligence from another world. Until that happens, it's the best we got.
One final question before we let you go. You know, we're sending all this stuff out, but could it be possible that there are messages coming to us that we don't have the capabilities within our limited senses to pick up? And if so, do you have any idea what form? Well, I guess if you had an idea what form they were, you could pick them up. But do you think we're missing out on something coming our way?
Yeah. So, and I think I have a little bit of a bias here, which I do believe strongly that extraterrestrial intelligence exists in the universe. The numbers, it would just be astounding to me if in the cosmos there is no other intelligent species out there. The question then becomes, can we actually make contact with them, right? It would be very difficult to communicate with someone on the other side of our own galaxy, much less in another galaxy. And so right now, all of our efforts have been focused on looking for signals within our local cosmic environment, in the sense of we're looking in the Milky Way. The problem, of course, is that we are limited by our own technology. So right now, the vast majority of SETI efforts are focused on looking for radio signals. You know, there's people that are scanning the sky essentially 24/7. We don't yet have full 24/7 coverage of the night sky. So there is a possibility that, you know, an alien signal hits the wrong side of the earth. And I'm simplifying here, but, you know, and the telescope just wasn't on, right? And so first thing we need to do is kind of get 24/7 monitoring up of the night sky. The problem then becomes, though, is that the universe is actually really radio noisy. And so these telescopes are pulling in a massive amount of data, and that's a lot of this data is now being filtered through with artificial intelligence to look for signals that appear to be artificial. And there's, you know, various ways that you can filter for these. But there is a possibility, and also as a side note, a lot of this data gets dumped. So it's not just like stored in some repository somewhere forever where we can now go back and look 20 years ago and be like, this was the data that we got. It's just too much. And so there is the possibility that we either don't know the format of the extraterrestrial signal in the way that we could actually extract that from this very noisy thing. We're talking about such large distances that the signal is probably going to be highly attenuated and very weak. So unlike the contact scenario where Jodie Foster receives like a, basically a video message from space, it's probably not going to be like that. It's going to be very, I think, unclear whether or not what we're actually looking at is artificial in origin. So I think there actually is, if aliens are broadcasting, there is a very high probability in my mind that we might have actually received a message, not know what it looks like, or just lost it in the haystack of all this radio data. And just kind of a final point there, when we think about radio as a mode of communication, SETI scientists have also considered, you know, using lasers, which are a great way to embed lots of information and have a lot of benefits over a radio. But at the end of the day, you know, we've had radio as a technology for a little over 100 years. So we are very young, technologically speaking. And the idea that an alien species that we might be able to make contact with is still using, you know, what might be considered a very crude way of communication. Like they might be looking at us as like, you guys are using the carrier pigeon of interstellar communication. we're talking on gravity waves or something. So, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So as science, I think, progresses, we'll continue to think about different modes of communication that might be better in this context. But for right now, we got to use what we have, and that is radio. And increasingly, people are considering lasers. But the idea that this really advanced civilization that's probably thousands of years older than us is still using radio, it's a little bit of a leap of the imagination, but it's we're forced to work with what we've got.
Well, our guest today has been Daniel Oberhaus. He is the author of the book Extraterrestrial Languages, and it's such a great book just to discuss the philosophy of the science, the moral implications of communicating with extraterrestrials. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
What does it take to be a creative person, to fully engage in creative abilities? Does one need access to the right hemisphere of the brain to create beautiful art? Is it a hint of madness required to create great music? Well, how much of the brain's structure and functioning forms the basis of creative work? Well, our guest, Anna Abraham, explores the correlations and myths of creativity with cognitive psychology and neuroscience in her new book, The Creative Brain, Myths and Truths. Anna is the director of the Torrance Center for Creativity and Talent Development at the University of Georgia, and she is also the author of The Neuroscience of Creativity and the editor of the multidisciplinary volume, The Cambridge Handbook of the Imagination. Woo! Anna, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start off with your definition of creativity.
I define a creative idea as one that is novel and satisfying.
So novel in the sense that it's never been seen before, I guess would be that, because I've read things about how the definition I've seen of creativity is it's taking things that have already existed and putting them into new ways, and then satisfying. What do you mean by satisfying?
So novelty can be things, is it has to be based on something you know, obviously, putting together things that you know, your source material tells you what you know and how you combine it in new ways to reach new insights, new solutions is where the novelty comes in. Satisfying is a very sort of internal metric that say you know if something works when you like the sentence that you've chosen for your poem, or you're happy or satisfied, you find that the solution you want is exactly what you wanted it to be. So satisfying is a little more of an emotive internal assessment. And so creative work is one that is experienced as being novel and satisfying either to the person making it or to the person receiving that work. And this is where things can perhaps varies. I can find something that I created to be quite creative, whereas you may not find that to be particularly creative.
I'm a writer, and so people always say, oh, you're so creative, I don't have it in me. But I think we all have a capacity for creativity. How do you feel about everyone's capacity to create something?
I agree with you. I think everyone is born with the capacity to create. It emanates from rather basic capacities that we have, the ability to explore and express oneself, but that we sort of feel the need to pursue it differently. So some of us are very, very strong in our drive to want to do creative things, to achieve creative sort of eminence, or at least strive towards it. And others don't feel that need. And I think of creativity as sort of, we should look at it more like we would things like physical fitness. Now, all of us are capable of moving. We're not all capable of being, I don't know, Usain Bolt and being the fastest people in the world. But it doesn't mean we ignore and don't acknowledge that we all have physical bodies that we need to move and maintain to a certain degree. So that's the way to think about creativity, I think, in that we have this capacity, but we're very varied in how much we're able to do with this capacity and how driven we are to do something with this capacity.
It's so great that you explained it that way, because it does seem like it's a muscle that we just need to exercise a little bit more. And I think especially with creativity, and Anna, I'm sure you can tell us more about this. People sort of decide if they are creative people or not, and then they go through the rest of their life believing one or the other about themselves and not really, you know, it's why creative people, I'll put that in air quotes, tend to be more creative throughout their lives, and non-creative people, you know, people just don't attempt creativity. What do you think is up with that?
It's really a relevant insight that you point. It's actually true. It's because we think of creative people as only being the Usain Bolt sort of equivalents, right? We look at creativity and we see eminence in creativity and we think that's what it is, and that we don't see it, we don't recognize it in its many forms, in its early forms. Then all of us are incredible in our capacities for what we can do. I mean, human beings as such, you and I can decide today to take on a new activity. We can decide, I'm assuming you're not a sculptor, we can say, you know what, let's do this. And we can chart the development of our capacity over time as we engage with it systematically, and we will improve and improve and improve. And we're kind of amazing in that respect. And I might give up and you might just persist on and find fulfillment and meaning and you know, and reach new heights with it. So that's the thing, that we don't see all of the hard work that goes into becoming eminent and becoming these amazing. It all starts from nowhere and nothing and very little, and with time and practice becomes what it is. And we kind of tend to be dazzled by the products of creativity. And because we can't see the process and the hard work and the years and years of trials and tribulations and frustrations that went into it, that we don't see that we can, you know, we don't even see that that is possible for us.
Right. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anna Abraham. She has written a new book. It's called The Creative Brain, Myths and Truths. And Anna, I love how you start your book in the introduction talking about these myths. And I think one of the biggest myths that I heard so many decades ago and just accepted is that the right side of our brain is, you know, from the right side emanates creativity. And I happen to be left-handed. And so, you know, along with that is like, well, if you're left-handed, then you're activating the right side of your brain. So if you're left-handed, you're more creative. Okay, tell us why that's a myth and where it came from.
Well, it's one of the more interesting stories when it comes to creative myths, in that it's an early idea that was promoted almost to counteract the left brain dominance of all the importance we were attributing to the left brain, because it's so important in intentional action and in language. And so it started to get, becomes being seen as the seat of, if you want, even civilization and so on. And so the right brain became sort of imbued with the opposite, the spirit of resistance, the spirit of passion and creativity. And it's not that the right brain is not involved in creativity. Of course it is. But creativity is a very, very, very complex ability that we have. And it involves many operations, many brain systems that are differentially evoked in each of us, depending on the way we think about things and imagine and so on. And so it's a misnomer, because it's taken too far. And people think about the right brain as being the only seat of creativity and the left brain has no role to play. That's completely untrue. But what it serves well now, I think, is a kind of metaphor. Because if someone says, you know, I want to exercise my right brain capacities, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It works so well as a metaphor. So it's a good It's a useful tool that we have in order to communicate with each other, affect change where we want to, change practices, whether it's in education, at the level of policy, and so on. So it will never go away because it's almost like it doesn't matter if it's not completely true. It captures something about the way we think about our world as being more left-brained and goal-directed and kind of boring and purposive, and more right-brained as being passion-oriented, creative, something that captures the human spirit.
One of the chapters in your book, you talk about the correlation of madness to creativity. And, you know, we've seen the mad geniuses, the Mozarts, the Picassos. And yes, they've done creative work, but is it the madness that created the creativity, or was it the madness that just propelled them to such a larger audience so that we know more about them, as opposed to the sane creators that are just doing their work and putting out beautiful things?
The observation that you just made, there's an interesting one. I don't even know if I covered in the book, which is that, are we drawn to the stories that are more interesting because there is madness in it and so on? The interesting thing about that myth is that there is a relationship between certain forms of mental illness and creativity, in that you tend to see certain occupations come up a lot in relation to creative disciplines. So there is something there, but we don't know what is. What came first? Is one leading to the other, or did they just happen to have surface similarities? So if you look at the world in a way that's unusual, or you see potential or opportunities that others don't, or you question the reality or the status quo, you can be seen as perhaps mad. And sometimes you're the person with the next best idea. And so sometimes there are surface similarities that might lead us to imagine that there are more similarities. And there are other things that are worth considering as well, in that in the case of the arts, at least, it's the most precarious, not the most, but one of the top most precarious forms of professions you can have. It's usually the professions that are not associated with full-time employment, benefits, and so on. So it's precarious in that people who are in the arts can't rely on very often on, you know, just a standard salary to come in on every month and so on, don't have a support system in place when things fall, such as what we saw in COVID. The first things that got cut were the arts funding. So being in a precarious position is a huge psychosocial factor that puts you at risk for certain forms of mental illness as well. So those sorts of considerations need to play in. There seems to be a link, but we're not really sure about the directionality. What's motivating what? Is it just surface level similarity, or is it something about the profession that is driving it?
Well, you talk about the arts as one of the forms of creativity, and I think so many of us just assume creativity only emerges as art or music or architecture. But it really does manifest in everything, like cooking and science and math. Why do we not typically appreciate these other forms of creativity? And we look at scientists as not creatives, and we look at, you know, mathematicians as not creatives, but they really are. Is that a different kind of creativity?
We don't know. I mean, it seems a different kind of creativity, but why we don't see it, readily recognize it, is because of the access problem, partly. So let's say if someone wins a Nobel Prize in physics, if you're anything like me, I don't really know that much about physics. Someone wins a prize, I'm like, okay, they're eminent. If someone wins the prize in literature, it's more accessible to us. Each of us, because our education systems are built the way they are, each of us are capable of reading big tomes of literature. So I don't know, remember when Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize? There's a lot of discussion. Is he deserving of this? Is this really literature? Is songwriting the same as writing a book? And so on. Why could we do that? It's because we're able to access, there's an access issue there. So the arts are more accessible than the sciences. It's more close to the bone. You look at a piece of art, you know immediately whether it resonates with you or not. Whereas the sciences and math, it's just so much domain-specific knowledge that if you don't know it, you can't really access it in the same form. So it's harder to recognize those forms as being creative. That's one thing. And like I want to say, in terms of domain-specific differences, you know, there's infinite number of ways to depict a falling apple, but there's only one way to explain why an apple falls. So it's also that there's more chances of seeing and recognizing creativity because it's in, you know, an artist can depict it in so many ways, whereas there are only select number of theories to explain phenomenon, right? So All of those issues are why we would see it more readily in the arts. But you're absolutely right. You can be creative in any sphere of human endeavor.
And it comes from both your right and left side of your brain. Anna, I'm wondering how you chart, how you measure creativity or see it, say, on a functional MRI. And the reason I ask this is because it would be really interesting. We talk a lot on the show about doing new things and what that does for our brain, especially as we age. And it would be interesting to take a person who doesn't fancy themselves a creative person at all, and then they start doing creative things, and what the difference would look like, how your brain lights up on a functional MRI.
Yeah. I mean, how you would do it would differ depending on the type of creativity or the type of creative process you're trying to isolate, or even the methods you use. So for instance, one way of looking at it would be to assess how you do any particular creative task on a task that's closely matched in almost every way, except that it doesn't require that you come up with novel responses. So I can ask you to, let's say, think of as many uses as you can for a common object, like a pen, or a pad like this, beyond its original use, and then give you a little time to do that. And while you're engaging in that, I can measure your brain activity. And then as a control task, I can give you something that's quite similar, but doesn't really push for you to come up with novel responses. So I can say, think of as many objects as you can that belong in a typical location, like an office. And so you can start to, okay, there's a desk, there's a table, there's a computer likely, perhaps some pictures and so on. It doesn't really require you to expand your concept of anything that you're given, like a common object. So when is a notepad no longer a notepad? What can I do to make it beyond just somewhere where you write something? So then you can look at the brain activity patterns between these two types of tasks that are pretty closely matched in terms of you're using language, you're recalling information. But in one, you're really trying to expand that concept, and the other, you're not. And so then I can look at which areas are involved as you're trying to expand concepts. So I can see, for instance, regardless of your level of expertise, parts of your control semantic networks are involved, the parts that are involved in retrieving information, the knowledge stores of your everything you know are activated, as are like the frontalmost areas that are involved in relational integration, sort of integrating inputs from multiple cognitive operations. When I compare experts, people who are really, really good at this sort of task, practical problem solving, yeah, compared to those who are less good at coming up with lots of ideas for how to use an object, you can see that these semantic networks are involved, but also another network of activity, area of activity, which is the salience network. So in the area that codes for what's meaningful to you. Yeah. And that will make sense because, of course, if you're doing an activity that you're really good at or that you enjoy doing, then this is not just a chore for you. When I say come up with this, you're not just thinking, oh, my gosh, but you're thinking, ooh, this is exciting. And then you can come up with things that are more meaningful and that it is more salient for you, for instance. So depending on the kind of task you have, our job is to try and think, OK, what is the task? How can we use a good control task? And then when we can think about what's involved generically when everybody would do it, regardless of ability differences. And then you could contrast people who are really very highly able with those who are a little less able to see, OK, are the same? Is it just more of the same, or is something qualitatively different happen? Are different networks coming into play then?
Ah, interesting. Okay, so in your book, you talk about this relationship between psychedelics and creativity, and it seems to be the era of the psychedelics. But, you know, drugs in general, you know, you hear the stories of people having ingested or smoked marijuana, and they think that they're coming up with something so brilliant and creative, and then afterwards they go, oh, that was really stupid.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that whole connection?
Yeah, we are in the era of psychedelic research, and in fact, there's so much funding going into it. The interesting about that research is because it's being done really carefully now. This just shows you the enormous possibilities of what taking such substances does to open your mind in very specific ways. And it's, of course, not with everyone. It's very case by case. It depends on setting. It depends on dosage, depends on the kind of drug and so on. But where it's been used a lot is just sort of the ideas that it allows you to look beyond the path of least resistance. So you're used to looking at things a certain way. Taking particularly psychedelic drugs, for instance, means that you're suddenly, that path breaks in that you're not looking at it in the normal way. It's not just a pen anymore. I can't imagine it as being something else. Yeah. So this would make some sense in relation to creativity. It allows you to see possibilities where you didn't see them before. And so that's what the research would sort of suggest that you would expect. Unfortunately, in the case of creativity research, the findings are very mixed, obviously, as you would expect in this kind of domain. And partly the problem is that people don't control for a really relevant personality trait when it comes to both creativity and the taking of psychedelic drugs, which is openness to experience. So your curiosity, openness to experience new things, to approach new opportunities is a really fundamental trait, one of the big five traits that you can assess. And it's really predictive of creative abilities, creative potential across age groups, whether you're looking at much younger people, much older people. And so, of course, the more open you are, the also more open you are to trying psychedelic drugs, for instance. So one of the problems with this field, at least when it comes to creativity, is it doesn't, since none of them really look at openness as a measure to control, we don't really know what it is that's improving, if at all it's improving, if it's really tied to the taking of the experience, the openness. So we could expect for lots of reasons that if you're really high on openness, maybe the drugs really don't do much to you. Whereas if you're pretty low on openness, it might open your mind a little bit more and you might come up with more ideas. The other aspect of the psychedelic experience is that there seems to be no, exactly what you said, like directly in that moment, it doesn't actually improve experiences. But there seems to be something that suggests that if you look further on beyond the immediate experience, but a few weeks later, the sort of after effects, the afterglow, sort of later effects, a lot of people report feeling more creative after that, or feeling like they're more open-minded, even though it doesn't necessarily translate to externally determined creativity, but internally determined creativity seems to be something that might improve. So those sorts of things are interesting to think about when the drug is still being taken. Can't really expect them to do much then. There's almost nothing to suggest that that would be immediately better. But there are certain long-term effects about the way it changes your perspective on the world that might also be quite individual based on what your baseline might be like beforehand.
Well, Anna, we've all heard stories of people that were in an accident or had some sort of traumatic brain injury, and all of a sudden they are drawing these amazing images or playing the piano. What happens in the brain, you know, when it's traumatized like that, to all of a sudden kick off this whole seemingly brand new realm of creativity for these people?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew the answer. It's one of those big mysteries. It's a phenomenon called paradoxical functional facilitation, where brain injury of some sort leads to an enhancement in function. It must be said that the enhancements you see are not necessarily creative. In fact, it's quite rare when you see it in the creative realm. It can be in other realms as well, just memory-based actions, perception and so on, this whole wonderful case study. So we don't know why it happens. We don't know why it's inconsistent, because if you look at the different, again, it's kind of a rare thing to study, but there's very little to generalize when you look across the kind of people who've gone into it. What we know, though, is that it speaks for the kind of intrinsic creativity of the human mind and the human brain, really, to... After trauma, what happens is that the brain tries to heal, tries to, you know, restore, repair. And in some cases, that restorative or reparation process can lead to pretty positive outcomes. And we wish we knew the secret of why that doesn't happen more consistently and why it happens only with some people. But it does speak to this, the kind of what has been referred to as the inherent creativity of the brain to sort of come up with solutions that deal with that problem. It's also worth thinking about in relation to creative artists. A lot of creative artists go on to develop brain disorders and so on. And what's remarkable there is that creativity is very hard to break. So people continue to create even through sort of really lots of dysfunctions, gradually debilitating functions. It's very hard to knock out creativity. They might change their style. They might change the hand they use because they can no longer use their right hand if they're right-handed. But people who are really pursuing their creative drive in a big way, unless their motivational system is so short that they're completely apathetic, unable to really move, their motor function is short, you rarely see that they stop. And this really speaks to what I've called like the disease-resistant capacity of the brain to be creative. There's something that, because it involves so many brain systems, it's so intrinsic to us. It starts from very early capacity to explore and make sense of the world. that it's very hard to knock out, unlike other functions where little lesions can knock out whole functions. That's the amazing thing about creativity. It's just there, and we can use it for rehabilitative purposes as well, as has been shown in the case of aphasia, where you can use melodic intonation therapy, a certain kind of music therapy, to affect speech function in certain forms of aphasia and so on. So it's the power of creativity is immense, and we're only starting to get to terms with how we can use it to affect other functions, to promote other functions in the context of healthy aging, for instance. It's something that's being looked at now.
Well, with aging and Alzheimer's patients, are they still able to access that creativity even though all of their memories may be gone?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of aging we're talking about. So with healthy aging, for instance, my own work has shown that much older participants are in the task that I showed you, the alternative uses task that I described, they're much better than younger people on that task, both in coming up with lots of ideas, coming up with highly original ideas across lots of participants. We've shown that. In the case of patients with Alzheimer's, the case studies that are there show that they continue to produce art. Very often what changes is the stylistic elements. So the way they use color changes, the form aspects of this perceptual elements of it change a lot. And we're not sure why that is, but they don't usually stop producing art.
Well, it just goes to show that creativity really does play such a big role in our lives beyond just good music and pretty paintings. Well, our guest today has been Anna Abraham. She is the author of the new book, The Creative Brain, Myths and Truths. Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. This has been a very fun and creative conversation.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it greatly, too.
You've been listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. You can always find our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab.